Blessed Easter to all of our readers and listeners of Catholic Insight. Christ is risen, truly he is risen. I hope you're all well as you continue whatever level of isolation. And I thought we'd have a few moments of meditation on law, particularly in light of St. Thomas More, the patron saint of lawyers, and who may allow us or help us to see our way through the thickets of laws that are crowding around us, and even the extension of various powers of the executive branch that were already creeping up before this crisis and now are being revealed, especially in certain locales, Britain and other places. But let's step back for a moment and just look at what law is and how law is applied and how we might apply law through the medium of our conscience. Saint John Henry Cardinal Newman wrote a famous letter to the Duke of Norfolk. We call it a letter, but it really is a treatise that he penned in 1875, consisting of about 150 pages, which even for a Victorian writer of Newman's caliber is quite the length. So it is a meditation, that letter to the Duke of Norfolk, on conscience. After Newman's conversion to the Catholicism, he was accused by his former fellow religionists, Anglicans, of submitting his conscience in slavery, so to speak, to the infallible will of the Pope. At that time was Blessed Pius IX. Newman had converted to Catholicism in 1847, and so had years of struggle from what he saw from Anglicanism as the via media to the full truth of Catholicism. But all through his life, he still struggled with certain aspects of the faith, not in a way of doubt or anything like that, but more in the realm of thinking deeply about what the faith meant and how it applied to him, to others, to questions of the modern world, in many ways presaging the Second Vatican Council. Newman is a lot like his fellow Englishman, Thomas More, who also had to struggle through questions of the faith as they applied to his own modern world back in the beginning of the 16th century and the complexities of the beginning of the Reformation under King Henry VIII, King Harry, and the rest of the Tudors who would follow upon his Mary, Tudor's daughter, by Catherine, and then Elizabeth, his daughter, by Anne Boleyn. I myself like to ponder what I call practical theology, to take the universal truths of Catholicism, that is theology, and then applying them to the real world in which we live. Now, that application, as Newman says, at the end of his 150-page letter, he has this famous quip where he says, if after dinner I had to make a toast, I would toast conscience first and then the Pope. So it's conscience that ultimately determines our action, and even the Pope, the Church, and all the truths of the Church are means to an end. Now, conscience is not completely free and unhinged. That is, it must be guided to its decisions, particularly its practical decisions, which is the role of conscience, to choose the course of action in any given concrete circumstance that we consider the best. That is, we talked briefly previously about the virtue of prudence, that is discerning the true good in every situation, the right means of attaining it. And prudence is the virtue that guides the act of conscience. Conscience is that act of judgment by which we discern what action is the best to perform in each and every circumstance. Now, we're guided to that conclusion not just by the truths of Catholicism, but also by laws, that is, human laws, but also ecclesiastical laws, liturgical laws. And as Thomas More says, we live in a thicket of laws, and those laws apply to us in different ways, in different circumstances, according to where we find ourselves and how we find ourselves in the here and the now. Now, some laws always bind us. These are the laws of God, and the laws of God manifested as the eternal law of God, that is the type within God himself, guiding all things to their final end, as Thomas puts it. And then one manifestation of that eternal law is what we call the natural law or the natural moral law, which is the rational creature's participation in the eternal law of God. That's St. Thomas's definition. But it is those universal precepts that we discover in our own hearts and minds that guide human conduct. But even natural law is applicable in different ways in different circumstances, according to the rights and duties in which we find ourselves in all the situations in life. We think of laws of modesty. Modesty, we mentioned before, has different applications according to whether we're swimming by ourselves, swimming with others, or are we giving a talk to a stadium full of people? Are we in a classroom? Are we shopping in the grocery store? All these things have different applications of the law of modesty, and even things like purity, chastity, truth telling. There's a complexity to how we apply the moral law, but the moral law in its universal precepts always applies. It is infallible, universal, and applicable to all human beings through space and time until the end of time. This is not quite the case with human law, what we might call positive law or civic law. These are laws framed by human beings to govern society. So St. Thomas defines law in his treatise on law, a very profitable read at this time. It's in the Prima Secundae of the Summa, beginning in question 90. He says, "Law is an ordinance of reason for the common good, promulgated by him who has charge of the community." Now, obviously, God could be the lawgiver, so we could see that natural law is promulgated in the hearts of men. But we usually take human law, or law in a sense, to be law that's framed by human beings for any given society. And the thing about human beings is they are not infallible. That is, they can be wrong, and law is an approximation to the good in every society, in every situation. And therefore, St. Thomas, in question 96, article 4, asks whether human law always binds in conscience. And he says, well, if human law is a direct expression of natural law, then it does bind in conscience. And so, human law, this is one way that human law is often formulated, is by taking the natural law as it has been handed on through the Judeo-Christian tradition and put into legal language. And those sorts of laws always bind us, laws against murder and theft, previously laws against adultery, which obviously aren't really applied nowadays, but other laws against certain sexual sins still do apply and are still formulated in our society. Now, if a law is in accord with natural law, it binds us. So a law may be unjust, that is, not in accord with our conscience, rightly formed conscience, if it violates natural law. So if a law goes against natural law, then we are bound not to obey it. So if a law, for example, in the early church requires us to worship idols or to give latria or adoration to a false god, then we must disobey even to the point of death. And the same would apply nowadays. We wouldn't so much have laws forcing us to worship false gods per se, but we would have laws forcing us to commit crimes against life in the health professions and whatnot. And even this may even creep down to our own level outside the medical field, and we are bound to disobey and to avoid such laws even unto death. And this is the stuff of which martyrs are made. And if you go back to Thomas More, this is what faced him in the time of Henry VIII. He had no illusions about King Harry, as he once quipped supposedly, "If my head could get him a castle in France, off it would go." So Thomas More tolerated the waywardness of his king. It was only when he was forced to sign the oath of supremacy, making King Henry head of the church in England, that Thomas More had to refuse putting his name to said oath, even though it lost him his own head at that point. That was a very long struggle for Thomas More, requiring much work and reflection in his own conscience. And it required him to analyze and ponder, well, what was the rightful jurisdiction of the Pope? and what was the rightful jurisdiction of the king. And he came to the conclusion that for the king to usurp supreme universal spiritual authority was to usurp the very right of the Pope, and more so the right of Christ and his church. And ergo, Thomas More could not obey. But there's another way that laws can be unjust. Laws can be unjust, as St. Thomas puts it, not so much by being against natural or divine law, but just by being unreasonable laws. Laws that may in some sense be even good, but go beyond a certain right or duty of the lawgiver, and also of the rights and duties of those who are under the law. And St. Thomas distinguishes here three aspects of a law that make it a law binding in conscience in any given society. And these are what he calls the end, the author, and the form of the law. So the end is whether the law is in accord with the common good of that specific society. So any society is going to be more or less subsidiary to broader or more universal societies, and any lawgiver has authority over the specific society given to him by laws themselves. So when I'm teaching class, the specific society over which I have some limited authority is the classroom, and my governance is for the common good of the classroom, and the common good of the classroom, or any given society, has to be defined in light of the specific purpose of that society itself. So in a classroom, the purpose of the classroom is to transmit knowledge and to the common pursuit of knowledge. And therefore, even though it may be good, for example, for the students to do push-ups or jumping jacks, it's not quite in accord with the common good of that classroom for me to make students do jumping jacks or push-ups. Or more to the point, to have them wear funny hats or to sit in certain ways that would also lead into the second aspect of whether a law, and that is the authority. That is, does the law, is it promulgated by the authority of that society, and is it within the scope of his authority? So the scope of his authority is only within the common good of that society. If it goes beyond the scope of their authority, it is no longer really a just law. It's not really a reasonable law going beyond what that specific authority can tell you to do or not to do. So I have no right as a teacher to tell students to do jumping jacks or push-ups unless that is specifically written into that society. If I was more of a drill sergeant and not a teacher of Christian doctrine or of theology or some other subject matter, to say nothing of math, philosophy, history, or literature. And vice versa, if I were teaching gym class, so to speak, I would not have the authority to intrude some sort of philosophical or mathematical teaching in the midst of the jumping jacks, push-ups, and running around the field. And the final element and what makes a law just or unjust, outside, of course, the natural law, is the form. And St. Thomas puts this as, is the law proportionately burdensome upon those who are under the law? So example I use sometimes in class is, if we were to have, for example, different laws for men and women in the college, let's say have a curfew where women had to come home 2 hours before the men, that would not be taken well. It would fall disproportionately upon the woman. And to make it more vivid, perhaps for our readers, we could think of tax laws that fall disproportionately burdensome upon certain segments of the society, that is the middle class and so on, and those who may produce wealth in the private sector. And even in the current COVID crisis, we could apply this if in certain regions, people are under what amounts more or less to house arrest. And if they see their politicians frolicking around freely, obviously it's going to create a good deal of resentment and anger, where some are under very burdensome laws and others are not. So to reiterate, a law is just if it has the right end, common good of the society, the right author, is it promulgated by the proper authority, and form, is it proportionately burdensome on those in society, or does it go beyond the realm of the lawgiver? St. Thomas says, if a law violates one of these three criteria of a just law, the law does not bind in conscience, but it is still best to obey the law to avoid what he calls scandal and disturbance. That is, to be seen to undermine the law would really undermine all law and really the authority of the lawgiver. And it is usually not our place to judge the laws unless they're clearly really against some sort of common good, author or form. And then we also avoid disturbance that is creating havoc in society. However, if we think we can avoid scandal or disturbance in some more private way, then we could say the law does not really bind. We can think to go back to certain laws in Ontario, where I live, like public drinking laws, not to harp on that too much, but people will enjoy a nip of scotch or whatever out in a camp or a campfire or a beer, even though the law strictly says that drinking is only allowed in private establishments or in those places that are licensed by the province. But as I mentioned before, we can think of other ways that laws or breaking of laws are tolerated by going a little bit above the speed limit, jaywalking laws, noise bylaws. Many other things are tolerated in society within what we call custom. And St. Thomas does say that custom is stronger than law. Custom are the ways that men and women act by force of habit in society. And customs are usually stronger than law, and customs must be tolerated by those in charge. So where does that leave us in the current context? If you think about the laws being put in place nowadays, which are sort of provisional laws in terms of the COVID crisis and the things that impose upon our freedom, freedom of movement, freedom of assembly, what we can consider, well, are these in accord with the common good? Do they extend beyond the rightful realm of lawmakers and law enforcers? And are they proportionally burdensome upon all segments of society? It's also vivid, perhaps, to many readers of Catholic Insight in terms of liturgical and sacramental laws imposed by bishops. And it's often good to, in these situations and thought experiments, to think in terms of extremes. That is, you think of one extreme versus another extreme, and then find some moderate and virtuous middle ground. So one might consider that letting things go on as normal might be imprudent given the current COVID virus, and in terms of sacramental participation, mass, confession, other things, we could consider that, okay, it might be imprudent and given how much we don't know, and certain limits on our freedom would be prudent. So let's take that as one extreme. Then the other extreme would be, well, too much strictures on freedom and worship and freedom of assembly would lead to even more deleterious consequences than not. And some things, as we mentioned in the previous podcast, we have a right to, and things that we, without that right and fulfilling certain duties, there will be what we call the law of unintended consequences. That is, worse things will happen that may not be intended, particularly in the realm of the spirit and the soul, as we talked about, which transcend the rights and duties of the body and even the political body of society. What is often quoted in this discussion is the final code of canon law, code 1752. I'm summarizing here, but the salvation of souls is the greatest law. So the highest law, summa lex, is the salvation of souls. And when the salvation of souls requires it, that would trump and supersede any human law. Now, we cannot dissociate the salvation of souls from that whole notion of necessity. St. Thomas discusses various points in the Summa. And necessity is a spectrum. What is necessary in any given situation would be anything from something that's slightly fitting for that situation. Is it necessary to do this or that for a wedding and to have lots of guests, pie, cake, food, drink, dancing? Well, they're sort of necessary in the sense of fitting, but what is absolutely necessary for a wedding are basically priest, two witnesses, and the promise. And even canon law says you can do without even that, some of that at least, and what you can get married if the delay will be long enough to find other aspects of the wedding ceremony, and the couple can make the vows on their own, hopefully in front of witnesses, and then have the marriage regularized when a priest is able to be found. So I'm glad to see that many dioceses have found creative ways to apply the sacraments, particularly the more necessary sacraments, that is necessary for salvation, particularly that is confession, and I would argue also baptism. And one could also put in their marriage that we cannot delay the right to marry for too long, otherwise people may fall into some sort of sin, and that may sound sort of odd, but the code and the tradition of the church is very clear about that, that people have a right to marry, and they have a right to have their confession heard and their sins absolved, and they have a right to have their children baptized into the Catholic Church, and then extending that, we're eventually going to have a right to receive the Eucharist. That right has been abrogated, one could argue for it or not, for the time being, but eventually we have to face the situation square on, and what it means to have a society that is the society of the Church and the whole sacramental system, without which the Church cannot continue to exist. We are incarnational beings. And as incarnational beings, we require incarnational sacraments to have that link to grace and the supernatural life. We cannot continue to exist in a virtual realm for too much longer. And how long that can go on, well, that's a prudential decision the hierarchy, our bishops, have to make. And in the meantime, we have to make in terms of those laws and that are put upon us. Again, it is best to obey the law. The prophet Hosea says obedience is better than sacrifice. And for those things that are not absolutely necessary, it is perhaps best that we do without, even that whole notion of spiritual fasting and giving up the right to the sacraments for the time being, to some extent at least, may be a beneficial, probably is a beneficial thing, and teaches us to be more intentional about the sacraments and to return to them when the day is right and the time is fitting with greater fervor, joy, and devotion. And hopefully with a greater realization amongst many Catholics of what the sacraments really are and what they're all about. In the meantime, there are creative ways of working within the law, but also performing our duties and our rights in a way that is, again, within the letter of the law, but also within the broader spirit of the law, and particularly the more universal law of God, the more universal necessity for the salvation of souls. And that goes back to the conscience of each and every one of us and how we apply the law to our own particular circumstances. So I'll leave you with the thought that the law, that is human law, and even the ecclesiastical laws of the church that are put in place by bishops, which have greater force in many ways than civic laws for us as Catholics, even those are a means to an end. And the end is ultimately the salvation of our souls and the souls of those around us. Particularly this applies for priests and our pastors as they work in a pastoral way to guide us through this crisis, but even beyond the crisis, to guide us through life, ultimately to heaven, which is really the goal of all our striving. Thomas More found his way through his own thicket of laws, but more properly, as he put it to his son-in-law Roper, it is by the tangle of our wits that we make our way not only to the end of this life, but also to the end that God intends for us, to heaven. So use those wits, use that conscience, ponder, pray for counsel, pray for wisdom, and pray for the guidance of the Holy Spirit. And be assured of my prayers for you all. And we'll have more to say about this in future podcasts. That's enough for now. I will wish you all a very happy and holy Easter. God's blessings upon you all.